The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory and evening grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. This is a special treat for me because I am spending a lot of time today with N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright is the former Bishop of Durham in the Church of England. He is one of the leading scholars of the Bible in the world. He is now serving as the chair of the New Testament Early Christianity at the School of Divinity at the University of St. Andrews. And he has a brand new book out, How God Became King, The Forgotten Story of the Gospels, which is linked at HughHewitt.com, which, along with Simply Christian, I think, will become must-reads for almost everyone who concerns himself with these subjects. Bishop Wright, welcome. It's great to have you on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Thank you. Very good to be with you.
It is a very interesting time to be speaking with you as Holy Week opens and with the elevation of Francis in Rome. On the latter, do you have a reaction to his election and his early statements?
Well, I haven't seen very much of what's been going on because I'm extremely busy at the moment with trying to finish a different book. But it was extremely exciting, really, to watch the election of a pope from the Americas for the first time ever, and particularly a pope from the Third World for the first time ever, if Argentina still counts as the Third World, which I suppose it does. And certainly his opening statements about the importance of the poor and the church's focus on the poor sounded as though that really is absolutely at the center for him, rather than simply being one of the things which we all know is important. For him, it seems to be absolutely at the center.
You will also be surprised, Bishop Wright, I think, when you read his inaugural homily, to find him talking about, in every period of history, there are Herods who plot death, wreak havoc, and mar the countenance of men and women, given how, in your new book, How God Became King, the third part of your book is all about that. And it's really quite eerie to have been reading his sermons while having been preparing for this interview and reading How God Became King.
Well, I'm grateful for the tip. I need to go online and get that homily. All I heard was little bits that were reported on our news bulletins. And as usual, the journalists just give you a quick soundbite and that's it.
I think you will find that first homily, it's linked at my website, to be quite amazing. Okay. Let's dive in then. Sure. Are you at all weighted down by the fact that really millions of people read your books and look to you for inspiration? Does that burden you?
I don't really think about that too much. Most of my time is spent actually thinking about the book that I'm currently trying to write, and as soon as that one's finished, I move on to the next one. From time to time, it is a bit scary to think of people reading stuff that I write. I very much doubt it's in the millions, but it's certainly a significant number. And the way I deal with that is that every Sunday morning I pray for the people who read what I've written, and especially for any clergy and preachers and pastors who are using stuff that I've written in order to preach and teach people, because that's a really, that's a big thing. If I got something wrong there and they're teaching people from it, then we're all in trouble. So I do pray regularly for the people who do that.
And do you mind or do you welcome the comparisons which are everywhere with C.S. Lewis?
I think it's a facile comparison in many ways, but I think it's just that for some reason C.S. Lewis was very important to me when I was young, and that's so for millions of people, of course. But in my case, I remember taking to heart his comments about what you have to do if you're going to be a Christian writer. He had this wonderful advice. He said, first, you have to be sure what it is you want to say, and second, you have to be sure that you say exactly that. Now, that sounds easy, but actually it's not. And I have struggled, and sometimes I hope I've succeeded in a measure to follow his advice. But I still, when I read him, I think, here is a master. I disagree with him on several issues, but his writing style is just so extraordinary that I should be so lucky to get anywhere near it.
Well, you do, and How God Became King has much of that winsomeness in it. Now, this is the most recent of many books by you, and I always ask authors who produce many books, you know, it's your most recent, so it probably represents your most mature thinking or the evolution of where you are. But it isn't your favorite child, and do you have a favorite child among all those books?
Somebody asked me that the other day, and it depends really how I'm feeling at the time. Right now, the favorite child I have is the one that is struggling to be born, which is the enormous big book on St. Paul, which I'm fiddling with the footnotes at the moment and the bibliographies and stuff. So it's basically written and it just needs to be polished off. It should be out later this year. And I find great satisfaction in that. But as I look back, actually, I do find How God Became King a very exciting book to have written. And I'm kind of surprised in a way that I hadn't said it before, because now it all seems so obvious to me, and yet I'm aware, and this is the point of the book, obviously, that an awful lot of people simply haven't looked at the Gospels like this, and I think we should. The other one that is really a big favorite child of mine is the Everyone commentary on Acts. I haven't written much about Acts before, but when I wrote that commentary, Acts for Everyone, it was enormously exciting. I was like going into retreat. I just had the whole of the book of Acts in my head for as long as it took to write it, and all I had to do was sit down at the desk, and it was like turning on a tap. I just couldn't stop. It was a very exciting, exhilarating time.
Oh, wow. Now, the opposite question, those who write many books and essays have a few spokes that they've thrown. Is there one you wish you could recall that you wish you hadn't written?
Now, that's an interesting question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. There's some essays that I think, well, I didn't really nail that one. But essays kind of go out into journals and they get quietly forgotten. I think some of the early volumes in the Everyone series, I was just trying to get into the style and the groove for that. And so I guess the Mark and Luke books particularly, one of these days I probably should go back and redo them. It won't be anytime soon, because I'm not sure that it all worked as well as it might have done. Yeah, that's actually quite a tricky question. I think as well, I have learned a huge amount in the last 20 years. My book writing has really been in the last 20 or 25 years. I really got going when I was in my late 30s, early 40s. And some of the stuff that I've learned in between does make me want to go back and do a quite fresh edition of the big book called The New Testament and the People of God, because there's a lot of stuff that if I was writing that now, I would put in and make more foregrounded than it was there. The problem is I don't have the time to do it, and it would result in the book growing to about 800 pages, which I don't think I particularly want to do.
Well, the reason I ask that is because when I finished How God Became King, I said to myself, wow, I've begun to think about the gospel writers as biographers. And biographers look back at their corpus of work. And Andrew Roberts is a friend, and he said, you know, Salisbury's too long, or this is too, and William Blake's Disraeli. I think of these biographers and some things they would want to do differently. And you're a writer and you're a biographer of these gospel writers in many respects, and you wonder if they knew now what they didn't know then about how the church would use their work, what would they have done differently?
Yeah, now that's a fascinating question, and I suppose they can be jolly grateful that they that they didn't know the messes that we would have made, or they would have been tearing their hair out and saying, is it any point in us starting at all? Because, of course, the culture has changed so much, and they could take so many things for granted that their readers and hearers wouldn't need spelling out, which we do need spelling out. You know, we just do things differently, and we think of things differently. And so little things which they could hint at, which their readers would pick up straight away, we have to spend ages looking things up in dictionaries and doing the historical background in order to gain one flicker of insight. So as things change over the years, that's bound to be the case.
I'm talking with N.T. Wright. Bishop Wright's new book, How God Became King, is linked at HughHewitt.com. Bishop, we have about a minute and a half to our first break.
Okay.
Could you just give us a quick summary of Canon Creed Gospel Dilemma?
Okay. I grew up in a church which said and still says the creeds day by day and week by week. And in the creed, you get this statement that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary, that he suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. And there's a skipping over of a lot of material there, straight from Bethlehem to Calvary, if you like. And of course, the church's year does something similar, that we go from Christmas to Easter with only really Lent and a little bit of Epiphany in between. And the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, don't do that at all. They spend a lot of time precisely on the material between the one and the other. And so there's a kind of a mismatch. And I suspect that for that reason, a lot of Christians haven't really known what all that stuff in the middle is all about. And that, in my mind, goes with the question of what the Christian life is all about in between, if you like, the baptism and the funeral. Once somebody gets converted, what are they supposed to be doing between then and when they die?
And that is the subject of How God Became King, and I'll be right back with its author, Bishop N.T. Wright. Go nowhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. A 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. It's a special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. My guest is N.T. Wright, the author of the brand new book, How God Became King, The Forgotten Story of the Gospels, which is linked at HughHewitt.com, author as well of many other wonderful, amazing books, Simply Christian among them. Bishop Wright, I'm using Mozart as my breaks in and out today because of what you wrote on page 157. I want to read it for the audience. You wrote, "As I read the Gospels and think of what the church has done and hasn't done with them, I'm reminded of the wonderful scene in Peter Schaeffer's play Amadeus. There, the cynical old court composer Salieri contrasts his own operas, telling and retelling great tales of legendary heroes, but through stale and tedious music, with Mozart's astonishing ability to take characters off the street and create something truly magical. He has taken ordinary people," says Salieri, "ordinary people, butlers and chambermaids, and he has made them gods and heroes. I've taken gods and heroes and made them ordinary." So, Bishop Wright, how is that what the church is? Explain what you then went on to write about.
Well, I think when we read the Gospels, often we make Jesus just another teacher, maybe a very fine teacher, but basically somebody who's telling us good advice about how we should live, about what the meaning of life is, and so on. And then people read a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and especially in churches which use a lectionary and work through the Gospels, as my own church does, you get maybe 10 or 12 verses on a Sunday morning, and the preacher will get up and turn that into a nice little homily about how you have to behave this week, or maybe how you should order your prayer life, or about the problems of the world or something. And we all sort of think, yeah, okay, fine, that's what that's about, and we go back to doing whatever we were doing. And meanwhile, I can see Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John going about their business saying, no, you don't understand. This is explosive. This is something breaking in. This is something which turns the world upside down and inside out. And you just turn it into little bits of stuff. And so I've going back to Mozart, I have the image in my mind. Imagine you go to a concert hall and the concertmaster says, okay, this week we're going to have bars 22 to 53 of the second movement of the Jupiter Symphony. And the orchestra plays just those 20-odd bars, and then the concertmaster says, okay, that's all, come back next week and you get the next 20 bars. And you think, no, this is an amazing symphony. I want to hear the whole thing, because only then do we realize just how powerful and life-changing it is. So I think there's a sense of domesticating what is, in fact, an extremely explosive and extraordinary narrative. And I think many Christians have just never even realized that it's like that.
Yeah, I'm going to give away the end of the book here, How God Became King. One of the things you recommend is something you did in the Durham diocese, which is to, during Holy Week, in fact, convene the church and read the entire gospel. Now, I must tell you, as a Roman Catholic Presbyterian, and I can explain that later, I always dreaded Passion Sunday, because you had to stand up for the whole doggone Passion. And I, you know, you're a little kid and you're sitting there and you're, oh, I don't. So the idea of the whole gospel, how did it go over with the congregation?
I think they loved it. They wove it into the liturgy, or rather they wove the liturgy into it, so that each Sunday, I think actually, I think it was through Lent. I just can't remember the details now, but it was one of the churches in the city of Durham that pioneered this, and they began with. It was Luke that year, so they began with the opening of Luke, and they just read that straight off. Then they had the first hymn, and then they read the next bit, and then they did the confession and absolution. Then they did the next bit, and then they said the intercessions or whatever. So it went, and it took a few weeks actually, but they got through it, and so they timed it so that, of course, the great Passion story happened then on Good Friday, and the Easter story on Easter Day itself. But so by the end of the sequence, they had actually lived through the whole of the gospel story, and they had, as I said, woven the liturgy, the stuff that you would normally have as the framework for the gospel reading. Instead, that became the filler in the sandwich, and the outer bits of the sandwich was the gospel itself. That was hugely creative and innovative, and it's the kind of thing that does a bishop's heart good, actually, to think that your parishes are coming up with creative ideas like that.
I love doing a bishop's heart good. I really do. I think I should do a good heart for you as well by recommending to you on this Christmas Day, if you're looking for a movie, go listen to all the wonderful English accents in The Darkest Hour. Because in there, Gary Oldman is nominated for a Golden Globe for playing Winston Churchill justifiably. So listen to Bishop Wright this Christmas Day and go find The Darkest Hour this Christmas afternoon here on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Four minutes after the hour, America 2, Hewitt talking with Bishop N.T. Wright about his brand new book, How God Became King, The Forgotten Story of the Gospels. But now here's my one overarching reaction before we go to the specifics, Bishop Wright. I am a dualist. I go to Mass on Saturday and to my Presbyterian church on Sunday, and I've had the benefit of both for many years, and a great theologian, and Mark Roberts is a friend and a pastor. So I actually don't, I was finding it a little alien as you talked about the dichotomy between the creed and the canon and the gospel. And I began to ask myself whether or not Catholics, especially those who say the rosary, they always say the Apostle Creed, and then it's immediately followed by the Our Father, and they reflect upon the mysteries of the gospel, which are themselves, for example, the mysteries of light include the arrival of the kingdom. Or in a liturgical setting, you get the Nicene Creed, but you only get it after you get the psalm and the responsorial psalm, the Old Testament, the epistle, and the gospel. So maybe the disintermediation between canon, creed, and gospel doesn't happen among the more liturgically rigorous. Is that possible?
It might. It still can, because it depends whether the The teaching is framed by the creed or by the canon. The creed was never designed as a teaching aid, but in many traditions and in seminaries and in churches where they have teaching programs, people say, well, we want to teach people what the faith is all about, so let's go to the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, and so we'll talk about God and we'll talk about Jesus and we'll talk about the Holy Spirit. But one of the key things then is if you ask the question, when does the kingdom happen? When does the kingdom of God happen? And for many, many people, many, many Christians, the kingdom of God means either when we go to heaven when we die, or something that will happen at the very end of time, because the creed says he will come again and his kingdom will have no end. And so people often imagine that the kingdom is something which will happen only in the future. And this is really the burden of the song throughout my book, of course, that in the Gospels, Jesus is inaugurating the kingdom. He's launching the kingdom on earth as in heaven in the present. And so I think however much people get the responsorial psalm and the Old Testament and the whole thing, and I love all that, that's great. I'd much rather have that than not. If they're still thinking in their heads and their hearts, but actually God isn't in charge, we're still waiting for that to happen, then they're missing out on something which is really central to what the four Gospels are trying to tell us.
Why do you think so many faithful Christians have missed that message of the kingdom of God being present? We have a minute to the break, Bishop.
I think in our own day, it's partly because in the Western world, the 18th century Enlightenment taught us to think of religion and spirituality as something private and only personal and not public, and so that the idea of God being in charge was quite offensive and still is offensive to many people, because they think that means a kind of ecclesial totalitarianism where you get priests to the hotline to God telling us all what to do and making us all afraid. And for 200 years, Western culture has been in severe reaction against that. So that is precisely the message of theocracy that people do not want to hear.
Bishop, I love great writing, and in great writing there is always great metaphor, and in How God Became King there are two, I'd call them killer apps, actually, the four speakers and the disassembled car. And so at the beginning, before we plunge into what each of those speakers is or is not playing and at what level it is amplified or distorted, would you explain the four speaker analogy, a metaphor? We'll come back to the car later.
Yeah, I'm not a great electrician or whatever, but from time to time when we've moved house, one of the things we ask ourselves is, okay, we have an electronic sound system, used to be record player, and then it was tapes, and now it's CDs, and we want that in the living room, and where are we going to put the loudspeakers? And if you have one of those really sophisticated sets that's got four loudspeakers, so you have one more or less at each corner of the room, you have to get them lined up and positioned. But you also have to get them turned up to the right volume, depending on where you're going to sit and so on, so that you get the proper balance. And I've used that as an illustration, because if you imagine, those speakers are designed to make you feel as though you're in the middle of the orchestra. If you listen to orchestral music, you'll have the violins over to one side, the basses over to the other side, the brass somewhere else, the woodwind somewhere else. And so you'll be able to feel spatially where you are in relation to them all. Now, if one of those speakers becomes unplugged or switched off, then the whole music is going to be distorted. There'll be things you're meant to hear that you're not hearing at all, or maybe only very faintly through the other speakers and so on. And I found, as I've used that illustration many times in speaking before I finally wrote it down, and it was interesting. It was something I think that most of my audiences were able to get hold of and understand. And part of my point then is to say that there are various themes in the Gospels which need the relevant speaker to be turned up to the proper volume. Otherwise, we just won't get what's going on.
And if I can add a note of explanation, the four speakers are not the four Gospels themselves. They are four themes.
That's important. Thank you.
So the first one, the four Gospels as the climax of the story of Israel, but you note that this speaker is kind of turned off because those creeds don't mention Israel at all.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's interesting. You've mentioned twice an earlier book of mine, Simply Christian. When I was writing that book, I thought to myself, well, what we'll have to have in the middle of it is a section on God, a section on Jesus, and a section on the Holy Spirit. And then I realized that actually, in order to get the Jesus section, I had to have a whole extra chapter on Israel, because unless you get the story of Israel firmly in your head, in other words, basically the Old Testament story and then what comes after that, you just don't understand why Jesus is who he is. And of course, the four Gospels knew that very well, and they tell the story in such a way as to make it clear. This is the climactic chapter in a much longer story or novel or drama or history, which they assume that their readers will know.
And that the church today has failed to tell in its full implications for the gospel.
Well, I think that's right, because, I mean, a well-taught Christian to this day will no doubt know the story of Abraham, of Noah, of Moses, of David, and we, you know, those of us who went to Sunday school still have got all that kit somewhere in our heads. But it's not usually seen as a continuous narrative running up to and climaxing in the story of Jesus. It's usually seen as a book of prophecies and illustrations and moral lessons and so on. And to be sure, it's all of those. And that's not wrong. But what it is much, much more is a single narrative of the way in which God's plan was working its way out. And that's the narrative that comes to its head in the story that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are telling.
That's the first speaker. And at this point, I want to introduce that at one point you say the so-called Gnostic Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas and the rest, or simply in another world. I thought to myself, using your analogy, it's like the person through the flat wall who's turned up their speakers very, very loud, and they're interfering with their music.
Yes, that's very good. I'm grateful for that. Next time I speak on it, I will use that. But that's exactly right, that it is interfering with the music. And somebody has just recently produced a book called is it the New Gospels or something like that? I'm not sure. The New Testament, trying to make out that actually we need to get all those other books in there as well. In fact, they will pull away from what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are doing.
Bishop Wright, the second speaker in the analogy of the four speakers playing four themes which have to be balanced in Christianity's story is about the story of Israel's God coming back as he always promised in the person of Jesus. And you write that the modern church has amplified this part, this speaker, because of two reasons: the rise and the threat of the new biblical criticism and of the new atheist. I want to play for you an exchange. I've hosted a lot of debates about God over my years on the air, and they're collected in an e-book called Talking with Pagans. And the most memorable of all those exchanges occurred with Richard Dawkins when he and I did this.
Do you believe Jesus turned water into wine?
Yes.
You seriously do?
Yes.
You actually think that Jesus got water and made all those molecules turn into wine?
Yes.
My God.
Yes.
Okay.
My God, actually, not yours. But let me
realize the kind of person I'm dealing with now.
That sort of perfectly encapsulated for me what you were talking about. When you run into Dawkins all the time, the tendency is for someone in my business to turn up the volume.
That's exactly right. It's very revealing. I've only met Dawkins a couple of times, but you know, he has lived all his life, or most of his life, in a world which is just the utterly secular world, where any sort of God is just not wanted on stage. Thank you very much. Actually, it isn't a modern world. It's ancient Epicureanism in modern dress. I don't know whether Dawkins realizes that or not, but this idea of banishing God away from the world so that he's got nothing to do with it. And then we overreact, and this is why, as you rightly say, the loudspeaker's been turned up too loud. Christians overreact by saying, yes, God is so big, he can do anything, he's great, he does this, that, and the other. And we forget the very specifically Jewish way of telling the story of God and the world. And this is actually very poignant. It's a story that people don't really know. But if you look at the book of Ezekiel, there at the beginning of the book of Ezekiel, it says that the people in Jerusalem and the priests in the temple have been so badly behaved and so idolatrous and so wicked that God is actually leaving the temple. And we have to realize that the temple in Jerusalem was always designed not to be just like a big church on a street corner somewhere, but to be the one place on planet Earth where the living God chose to dwell personally. It was his own residence. And so the idea he would leave and go somewhere we don't know where is terrifying. And, of course, Jerusalem was destroyed as a result. But then the prophets like Isaiah, and the great prophet Isaiah, 40 to 55 particularly, basically says he's coming back, and you'll see him come back, and you'll rejoice and celebrate because he's coming back, and he's coming back to be king. And the New Testament is written to say, yes, and he did it, and it looked like this. It looked like Jesus of Nazareth coming back and and he came to be king. So we don't realize that this idea of a personal God who has long been awaited is actually returning, and but he's not returning in a blaze of glory and flashing fire. He's returning in and as a human being. And that gives to the whole idea of who God is a much more focused image and picture than we, certainly that I got growing up as a regular churchgoer or that I knew from my own theological training.
Which is saying something, given the amount of theological training Bishop Wright has. To continue our conversation with N.T. Wright, just stay tuned. Don't forget on this Christmas Day, which I hope you're home enjoying with your family and to our service members abroad, a Merry Christmas to you. Thank you for what you are doing. Don't forget, if you are near a theater, away or close, you might go see The Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. He's been nominated for a Golden Globe in that picture, and justifiably so. It's such an incredible, inspiring story of World War II. At its opening, Winston Churchill takes command, and boy, does he take command, as you'll find in The Goldest Hour. And don't go anywhere. I will be right back with Bishop N.T. Wright to continue our Christmas show here on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt with Bishop N.T. Wright, his brand new book, How God Became King. Now, what's very fascinating about this, because I'm afraid to turn down the volume of that second speaker because of the noise out there. And a friend of mine, I consulted three people when I was getting ready to talk to you, and I asked, they're all great fans of yours. One of them, Steve Temp, sent me this question, which fits right here. In applying the wide-angle lens of the new creation in the kingdom of heaven, does Bishop Wright sense any risk that a message of personal sin and salvation is lost and weakened? What is the message? I mean, i.e., is our traditional evangelical understanding of the Roman road string of salvation verses still valid? And how would the bishop communicate that message to my unbelieving neighbor who wants to know why I am a Christian and why he or she should become one? And if we turn down the volume, I'm adding this on, don't we give up on that neighbor?
No, I mean, if you've got the volume turned up too loud, then you won't be able to hear the nuances in the music. You know, you'll just blast everybody out and make the whole room shake, but you won't actually be able to distinguish the oboes from the clarinets, from the basses, from the violins, going back to the orchestra again. And it's the nuanced reading of the New Testament which will actually appeal, because people don't know it. Christians don't know it, and atheists certainly don't know it. And so the atheist simply thinks that you and I believe in this big bully in the sky who is coming to get you and will occasionally do funny tricks like changing water into wine, but basically he's a distant god who has got a very severe moral program for us, and he is capable of doing anything he wants, but we don't normally understand it. And this is a very un-Jewish vision of God. This is a combination of older pagan views of God, and part of our trouble in the Western world today is that we've forgotten that there are many different meanings to the word God. And clearly, Dawkins has one vision of of who God is in his mind, and it's quite different from what you find in the New Testament. So we have to turn the volume down so that instead of people just hearing us thundering on about God, 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 we actually say, no, wait a minute, we're talking about the God we see in Jesus. Now let's just calm down and look more closely at this. And you see, this fits because one of the things that we learn when we do that is that God isn't a big thundering bully, that God is like Jesus. Michael Ramsey once said, great Archbishop Michael Ramsey once said, that God is Christ-like and in him is no unchristlikeness at all. That's part of what it means to believe in the incarnation. St. John put it like this: no one has ever seen God, but the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father has made him known. Now, we've shouted so loud, God, 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 but people have heard the God of late Western imagination, not the God of the Bible.
Bishop Wright, did you know Hitch?
No, never met him or his brother either, who is still alive.
Yeah, I've talked with Peter on the air, but but Hitch was a friend, a journalist friend, and 70 times he came here, and I never made a dent, or at least he said he never had a dent made. What happens there to your idea of balancing the speakers?
Well, nothing in what I'm saying implies that if we do our homework and get it all right, everybody in the world is going to keel over and say, oh, I get it now, fine, okay, I'm going to become a Christian. It's much more complicated than that. Paul addresses this question in 2 Corinthians 4 when he talks about the God of this world blinding the hearts of unbelievers. And there's a deep mystery there. And I think part of the problem is that, again, in our modern Western world, we have assumed a sort of 18th century rationalism, which says, if I only explain this clearly, everyone will understand and believe it. And the trouble with that is that, yes, I can explain it clearly, but if it requires a whole worldview shift, then people perhaps are never going to get it because they like the worldview the way they've got it. And unless something happens to jolt them out of that, then they may well just not want to change at all.
Now, I'm not going to ask you whether you think Hitch is up in heaven or down in hell, but I do want to say to people that you deal with the problem of hell in How God Became King, but in an interesting way, in that you just urge people a more sophisticated version of it. But you do believe in hell, correct?
Well, it depends what you mean by hell. Like, it depends what you mean by God. Let's put it this way. I do believe that all humans have the chance, if they choose, to dehumanize themselves by, the Bible has this word, idolatry, worshipping idols. If you worship that which is not God, you stop being a genuine human, little by little. And I believe that after death, if somebody has made that choice, no, I'm not going to worship the true God, I'm going to do my own thing, I'm going to worship whatever I want instead, then that choice is, as it were, ratified, and that God will not, as it were, change the rules of the game at the last second so that you don't have to suffer the results of the choices you've made. Now, if that's a way of talking about hell, then fine. Okay, my fear is that our picture of hell often is actually a pagan picture. They believed in hell in the ancient pagan Roman world. They had a lot more in ancient classical mythology about hell than there is in the New Testament, curiously. And what happened in the Middle Ages was that people got hold of that vision of hell, and they made that a huge, great bogey monster to beat people up with. And so there's been a natural reaction against that by people who realize in the New Testament that the picture is a bit different from that.
I'll be right back with Bishop N.T. Wright. His new book is How God Became King. Hour 2 straight ahead on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. The 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384.